Hi guys, welcome back to What's On Your Mind. I'm here today with Dr. Alexandra Solomon, one of today's most trusted voices in the world of relationships and is widely acclaimed for her framework of relational self-awareness. She's a couples therapist, speaker, author, professor, podcast host, retreat leader, and media personality reaching millions of people around the world. Before we get into today's wonderful conversation, here's a word from our sponsor.
What would your life be like if you relentlessly lived authentically? Would you be living in the same area? Would you be dating the same person? Would you be spending money on the same things as you are now? In order to find these answers, you must first learn true self-worth. Come learn to embody true self-worth in Bali with me, Liana Jabs, this summer. This is a retreat where you will learn to embrace all that you are, uncover the deepest parts of your soul, and create human connection in a magical atmosphere at the Gaia Retreat Center in Bali, so that you can leave the retreat embodying your true self, feeling confident and empowered, and finally able to unconditionally love yourself. Listeners of the What's On Your Mind podcast get $300 off the total cost of the retreat. Visit lovewithliana.com/retreats to get started on your journey to embody true self-worth.
Hi guys, welcome back to What's On Your Mind. I'm here today with Dr. Alexandra Solomon, one of today's most trusted voices in the world of relationships and her framework of relational self-awareness. She's a couples therapist, speaker, author, professor, podcast host, retreat leader, and media personality reaching millions of people across the globe. While she's a clinical educator and a frequent contributor to several academic journals, she translates her experience to her Instagram page, garnering over 200,000 followers. She also has a hit podcast, which is personally one of my favorite podcasts, called Reimagining Love, where she features high-profile guests from around the world talking about therapy, academia, pop culture, and more. She is an award-winning author as well of two books, Taking Sexy Back, How to Own Your Sexuality and Create Relationships You Want, and Loving Bravely, 20 Lessons of Self-Discovery to help you get the love you want. Dr. Alexandra, thank you so much for being here. Why don't you say hi?
Hi, Anaya. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, before we get started, why don't you give us a little rundown of who you are and what you do in your own words?
Yeah, well, you did a great job of introducing. I have had a long and winding career, and I love the fact that my work requires me to wear a few different hats. So I'm a clinical psychologist by training. I trained at Northwestern University and have been there in some way, shape, or form ever since. So some of the time I teach an undergraduate relationship education course called Marriage 101. I spent a long time training graduate students to become marriage and family therapists. I spent a lot of time translating my work into books and social media feeds. And I mean, basically the bottom line is that I'm just super nerdy about helping people love and be loved with curiosity, with authenticity, and with integrity. And I love that in this career of mine, I've been able to find ways to, you know, grow it and shrink it throughout the decades, and that I'm really never bored. I am constantly trying to figure out, you know, what's the next topic that I want to unpack? What, how can I choose projects that feel really meaningful and rewarding for me and then for the audiences that I serve?
What is something that you haven't unpacked yet that you're really excited to dive into?
We're working on a couple of podcast episodes for January that are going to be about where is the line. I'm sort of imagining a spectrum that goes from people pleasing, where you only say out loud the stuff that other people want to hear, and the other end of the spectrum being sort of brutal honesty, that there's just no filter. You're just hyper blunt. You say what you say and everyone's got to deal with it. And then some sort of like shade of gray in the middle that's about relational truth-telling. How do we be honest in our relationships while keeping the relational context in mind, keeping respect in mind, accountability and responsibility in mind? So that's been really fun for me to kind of figure out how do we unpack that? You know, I love taking a topic like that, this idea of truth-telling. What is truth? Why do we tell the truth? What does it mean to tell the truth? Where's the line between privacy and secrecy? I love that kind of like juicy dynamic that's about me, you, and we, and then figuring out how to create an episode that has kind of an arc to it that serves the listener, So that's just my happy place. But you could put me down in the middle, you know, of jealousy or, you know, sexual desire discrepancy or, you know, any topic under the sun that has to do with relationships. And I will get really curious about how to kind of roll out the map, help people locate themselves and figure and have the tools they need to handle things that are complicated and that don't give us easy answers. I think there's a lot of relationship content out there that plays at the idea that relationships are simple. If you just do step one, step two, step three, you're going to have it figured out. And everything I do kind of pushes back on the idea. I don't think relationships will ever be simple for us, but I think we can become increasingly able to sit comfortably in complexity, to sit comfortably in nuance, to sit comfortably in mystery and paradox.
Definitely. And I think it's just a very interesting field of study that's not often talked about because it's almost like we should know and we do know, whereas many of us don't. You know, it's really hard to really navigate the nuances of the little complex situations that relationships tend to hold.
Yeah. Well, and especially, you know, I'm thinking about you and your audience. You know, you are really committed to serving, you know, Gen Z and helping. And I think that is like, this is the time, like the emerging adulthood is a time that is so ripe for starting to figure this out. And I love that you and your listeners are already sitting with life's tricky questions, right? And just learning, mm-hmm. figuring out how do you resource yourself? Because I've been teaching Marriage 101, you know, which is for undergrads, as I said, but teaching that class for 20 plus years. Like I've been teaching that class for longer than I've been a mom. And I've got, you know, my kids are not babies. I've been at this for a long time. And the thing that I have heard hundreds and hundreds of times is from people in their 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s who say, where was this class when I was, you know, 19, 20, 21. So
definitely,
it's the thing that I probably most admire about Gen Z, about today's mm-hmm. emerging adults, is that they're just like, my students now come into my class, they know their love language, they know their attachment style, like they, you know, they understand the terrain of their mental health challenges. Like there's just a kind of introspection that many emerging adults are just growing up with. I think that has to do with how you were raised. I think there's, you know, like hats off to the mamas and daddies and parents of the world who have done their own work and then are able to raise their kids with more awareness than, like, you know, I'm a Gen X. Like my family didn't grow up. Yeah. I guess my mom had some self-help books, like the self-help movement is, mm-hmm. you know, from the 70s. Yeah. But anyways, it's just, you know, it's a different time. And you all, I watch how you all tool yourselves and it's wonderful.
There's a sense of self-awareness, I think, that comes with this generation that may not have existed in the past because there's so much information at our disposal.
Yes, that's right. That's right. In fact, now, like, you know, I spent the first part of my career helping people, like exporting relationship education, exporting high quality sexual education content. Like that was my job, was like, you know, shouting the stuff from the rooftops. And now it's interesting. My job now is helping people refine because there is so much information available that now I'm like, okay, really like check your sources, like not all of your exes had narcissism. Not everybody in your world has an avoidant personality, you know, style. Like just like now it's almost like having to help people be more discerning because there's just so much information. I had a student last year come to my office hours and just plop down and be like, okay, so I saw on TikTok. I was like, okay, I freaking know you did not just walk into Professor Solomon's office wanting to break down something you saw on freaking TikTok. Okay, wow. I'm going to take a breath because I just gave you an entire curriculum. You know, we've got bell hooks. We've got like, you know, I've given you like the big names here and you're about to quote me some TikTok. It's so funny. So I think that is your generation's growing edge probably is being discerning about not all information is created equally.
Yeah, definitely. And I struggle with that myself. I'm like, do I really listen to this one person that said this one thing? Or do I listen to Dr. Solomon, who's been doing this for 20 years, right? Mm-hmm. But help us identify some of those myths that popular culture has kind of spread.
Mm-hmm. I do think that it's pretty catchy to give people fancy words to describe other people. You know what I mean? Like the whole idea of narcissism, right? So just giving people like kind of, just like fancy tools for pointing, you know, I think we all have a tendency to point our fingers. You know, it really, it's so much easier to see a relationship problem as being something that you're doing wrong or in an unhelpful way versus like holding up that mirror and looking at, you know, how we might be contributing to the problem. I think that's a huge issue. Like every time I start a new therapy with a couple, for example, you know, that couple mm-hmm. is coming in and each of them is imagining that couples therapy is about helping their partner change. Like, I think it really is mm-hmm. so much easier to see the problem in a relationship dynamic as being you're too rigid or you are, you know, too controlling or you are too lazy or you like, we, it's really easy to kind of externalize. And so I think that there's a way in which some of the content that's available is about externalizing just with bigger words, like you're, you know, avoidant, you're a narcissist, you're like all those things I was saying before. I think that's one of the risks, is just making sure that the content you're consuming really is helping you understand yourself better versus okay. helping you get more clever about how you're going to pick somebody else apart.
When it comes to that line though, right? Because I feel like that is also a slippery slope, is how much are you going to criticize yourself to death's end, right? That's so right. What's the line between criticizing yourself and criticizing others?
Mm-hmm. Well, you're right. That's the exact, I mean, the opposite is as problematic, right? Is like taking the content you're consuming and pathologizing the heck out of yourself. Like that's another huge risk, is identifying all of the, you know, all of your growing edges as being, you know, traumas or wounds or weaknesses, right? And so I think any self-exploration has to be rooted in deep, deep, deep self-compassion, like mm-hmm. deep self-compassion, to just like take as your first assumption, I am whole as I am. Like just that's not any exploration I do has to be about, I am whole as I am. And I can look at my edges. I can look at my challenges, but it's from that foundation of just being on my, I'm on my team. And that I think that it's also about just like honoring that the goal isn't to reach some place of like doneness or perfection. Like you get to keep all of your quirks and your foibles and your edges. Like you get to keep those because those are what makes you you. And so you know, I think any of us could put a label on any of our quirks, you know? But I think I want people to be really careful about that also, because it's also what makes you you. And so holding on to whatever you identify as a, you know, problematic aspect of yourself, making sure you're also looking at how that also serves you. You know, like for me, that might be, I have a really strong, I'm really, really ambitious. And I know that in part, my ambition comes from, I think it was a coping strategy when I was, you know, I grew up in a pretty chaotic family. And so I think that being really driven, being really attentive with my homework, I think that was a coping strategy. It kept me feeling a sense of control over my world when a lot of the things I was seeing in my family were really, really quite out of control. You know, my parents were really struggling as they raised me. And so I think creating a little world of homework and academic achievement made me feel quite safe and quite in control. Okay, so fine. So I grow up and now I am a, you know, really driven grown up, right? And that's...
Yep.
And so I'm not, so I have to resist the urge to beat myself up about that and to honor that that comes from, you know, that was an original coping strategy and I need to always be refining it and cutting myself slack and giving myself breaks and rest while also acknowledging that that's part of how my gifts show up in the world, you know? So that's not to be fixed or solved, right? It's just to be worked with.
How does your ambition show up differently from when you were younger to when to now?
Oh, that's so interesting. I've never been asked that before. Oh, you're so good at this. Oh my gosh.
Thank you.
Oh, I love that question. I think that a lot of schooling, like high school and even into college, a lot of it is figuring out what somebody else wants and like trying to figure out some kind of like external standard and like just kind of playing the game. Like every class you sign up for is like a game. Okay. So what are the rules that, you know, the syllabus is like the rules of the game, you know, and you're trying to kind of like solve the game, figure out how to play it. And it's really external. I mean, sometimes when you get to, I guess if you get to choose a project, you can figure out, you know, how to make the content meaningful for yourself. But by and large, you're figuring out how to play somebody else's game. And I think what's different for me now, even though I do sometimes, I think that's one of the traps for me. And I'm sure you find this too. One of the traps of social media and podcasting is there is some of it, which is about figuring out the game of what's, but the game is really, what do people want? And so I'm trying to figure out the goodness of fit between my interests and expertise and what people want. So there's no like abandoning of myself when I'm choosing things. I get to figure out where's the intersection of what's going to be really good for my audience that also lights me up, that also keeps me engaged. So I think that's probably the difference, is I'm more so playing my own game now versus somebody else's game.
Interesting. If you could go back and kind of alter that experience so that you were more in touch with yourself, how would you do that?
When I was younger?
Yeah.
There's a way in which I don't know that I, like, especially in high school, I probably wouldn't alter it, because it really did. Like it really was a survival strategy for me, you know? Right. So I don't know that I mean, if I could go back and change it, I would have had, you know, grownups in my house who were taking care of themselves better than the grownups in my house were, you know, like that would be the thing I would change. Cause if they weren't struggling the way they were struggling, I wouldn't have had to cope the way I coped, you know, like that's probably more so.
Right.
But I think given the household I was raised in, I think I did what it needed to be done, which really I think can be said for any of us, right? That when we're young, we do what needs to be done. You know, the nature of being little and growing up in a family is that you really do have to do what needs to be done, you know, because you need to belong within your family. You need to find pockets of safety, whatever that looks like, whatever that takes, you know, and that's the beauty of growing up, is that you get to then create safety. You know, you aren't as dependent on somebody else for safety the way that we are when we're young. So those are some thoughts about that.
So how does that desire for safety manifest as we get older? How does that show up?
Well, one of the big ways is intimate partnership, right? I mean, you know, what the science of attachment has taught us is that the way that we need our caregivers when we're little, we don't outgrow that. We don't outgrow the need for safety and connection and feeling seen and understood. We don't outgrow that. Like we never become, you know, like self-contained units. We just grow up and we transfer that need to our adult relationships, you know, primarily our adult intimate relationship for those of us who grow up and become partnered, that we become interdependent with our adult romantic partner. And I think that can be something that people of all ages, I think, really struggle with, right? Is the idea that, well, wait, I'm grown up. I should be independent. Now I'm dating and partnering with somebody. Ugh, I kind of need them and they need me. And like, where is the line between having a need and being needy? Like when is, you know, I think that becomes really tricky. It's much, much trickier in adulthood in a romantic relationship than when we're little, because when we're little, we just need people because we can't do things for ourselves. We, you know, so it transfers, but it also transforms.
Right. And that, I feel like that the line between dependency and interdependency is very jaded, but is there a quote right in the line of dependency and interdependency?
Mm-mm. No, that line gets figured out for a couple, you know, the two of them figure that out together and they refigure it out again and again and again and again, because a couple, for example, with a brand new little baby, they are far more dependent on each other than a couple that is emptying their nest, right? Like the need for collaboration, coordination, you know, being super clear in who's doing what, when, where, and why is it's a tighter kind of situation than when a couple has emptied their nest and there's more choice and freedom. And, you know, in fact, that's why when you look at the research about divorce, there's a spike. You know, what we would call like a bimodal distribution. There's a spike in divorces around year 7 and a second spike in divorces around year 20. And that tends to correspond with, a couple becoming a family, like kind of the birth of the first child is really destabilizing. And so some marriages, you know, won't survive that transition. But then that second bump happens as a couple empties their nest, because the things that kept them together perhaps now have to get figured out. We are no longer together because we have to be together because we've got these little people. We're together because we choose to be together. So a couple needs to really renegotiate around the empty nest. The line between dependence and interdependence has to get figured out again, like at the other point of marriage. So it's both things, right? It's like sort of temperamentally who the couple is, and it's developmentally, it changes over time, that line between dependence and interdependence. What do you think though? What do you see among, is it something that you feel like you and your peers are figuring out also of like, am I here because I want to be? Am I here because I need to be? What does it mean to need somebody? Like, are those the kinds of things that you are thinking about and talking about with friends?
I wanted to, when I was thinking about what I really wanted to talk to you about, I asked people, I was like, what's the biggest question you have about relationships? And I asked a couple people my age, but I asked a lot of elders too. And I think a lot of people also had that question, was not only dependence, but emotional dependence. Yeah. What's the line of emotional dependence and independence? Because, you know, as we get, not only as we get older, but when you're older, you know, how do you know? I'm sure people question, right?
So. Right. Yeah. And I think we always need to know how to like tend to our own flame, how to soothe ourselves. Like it is not healthy to offload your self-soothing onto your intimate partner, right? It just isn't, it's draining for a relationship. Yep. And it's risky, because what if you aren't there? What if you're working against tight deadline and I'm super anxious, but I don't know how to soothe myself? Like, you can't, you know, a partner can't always be available. So we do always have to have self-soothing. But part of what makes a relationship feel safe is that we do turn to each other with our emotional needs. Like, that's what intimacy is, right? So that's part of what's so beautiful about being part of a couple, is that you don't have to do it all yourself. My husband and I just had a thing earlier this week. I got into, did something hurtful to our daughter. Like, I hurt her feelings. I did something to her that hurt her feelings, and I felt really badly about it. And I was, you know, feeling kind of confused and overwhelmed. And Todd and I went for a walk, and he just like helped me sort it through. Like, I could have sorted it through on my own, right? I'm literally a therapist, but it was so helpful to have him to talk to. That is a huge benefit of an intimate partnership where you have worked on creating emotional safety, is that I didn't have to shut down and figure it out all on my own, even though part of me wanted to hide from him because I felt embarrassed about what I had done. I felt worried that he was going to be critical of me, but I know that we've got this like deep well of years and years of trust between us. I know that he can hold me in warm regard, even when my behavior has been, you know, shady McGrady, like less than ideal. And so that was like beautiful that I could, right? I could turn to him and he could help me sort it through, you know, together. I don't think you ever solve for the exact perfect blend of emotion, you know, supporting each other versus supporting yourselves. I think you kind of keep figuring it out over time.
Definitely. You see that often too, I think, in friendships where, you know, at this age, you're building relationships and you're building friendships. And my mom always says to me, I cannot build the same friendships now that I could when I was your age, because I feel like right now, in a way, we are reliant on our friends in that sort of capacity, right? We rely on our friends for some emotional safety. Yeah. And it's it changes as you grow up.
Would she say it's because she turns to her partner now for emotional needs?
She turns to her partner and she turns to her childhood friends, right? It's not necessarily the friends that she made a year ago, right? Mm-hmm. Because she cannot build that same kind of connection because there's a sense of emotional dependency or there was, right? Yeah. Historically with these childhood friends.
Yep. Yep. I just did a podcast episode that came out this week with my best friend of 40. We've been best friends since we were 10. And that is one of the things that we were talking about in the episode is that, yeah, I mean, we don't have to work at emotional safety because it's just been locked in for 4 decades. And we became women together. Like there's really very little of my history that she wasn't there for. There's very little that I ever had to figure out in my life without her being right next to me, figuring it out alongside me. So there is something just so, so irreplaceable about longevity. Same thing in a marriage, right? You know, could I have a different intimate partner at this stage in my life? Of course, like there are kick-ass second marriages, right? Beautiful, like life love stories. Of course, of course. And it would not be, right? I will never fall in love the same way that I fell in love with Todd. Like that's not replaceable. This history is not replaceable. In fact, that can be sometimes what keeps people in a long-time marriage is just that awareness of like, oh, my next partner will never have known 21-year-old me. Like we won't, you know, you don't have that same history. So
And it's interesting how that plays a role or such a huge role in our relationships is that you need to have time together and the time that you've spent together, it's always there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that can be, you tell me, but it seems like it's one of the challenges of this kind of the age of social media is we are so used to kind of quick, like having quick hits, quick answers. Like we literally don't ever sit with questions anymore. If you have a question, you just Google it and you have an answer in like fractions of a second. I think it's compromised our patience and our tolerance for not knowing, but that's exactly what's required. Yes. Like in order to date, in order to build a friendship, like you have to not know for a long ass time. Like you have to not know, and you have to just keep investing because you can't, when it comes to relationships, like there's nothing you can do about that X axis of time. Like you just need time and repeated experiences with somebody in order to build something. Like it just takes time. And we're not used to that anymore. We're used to like, you want it, like my shoes from Zappos will arrive tomorrow. You know, the thing I ordered on Amazon is going to arrive in 5 hours. Like that's freaking weird. Like, how does, you know, just all of that. We're so used to things being kind of hyperspeed. We're not used to having to go slow, tolerate uncertainty, tolerate discomfort.
No. And yeah, I mean, I definitely feel that. And I know a lot of people can relate to that. And I know it doesn't only impact Gen Z, but it impacts it impacts adults too. Like they want it now. They want it fast. They want it sometimes even faster than we do. So it's very like, go, 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 go all the time.
Yeah. I remember seeing a study that was like the number of parents who bug their kids to put their phones down is the exact same number of kids that bug their parents to put their phones down.
Yeah.
So this whole thing that, you know, whenever I'm like talking to parents and they start like lamenting, my kids are on their phone all the time. I'm like, stop it. You are too. And if your kids were here, they would tell you that you need to put your phone down also. So
Yeah. Tell us more a little bit about that sense of uncertainty and waiting and what that can really give us, because I feel like we're talking about, right? It's always go, 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 and let's do it now. But what can waiting really give us?
That's a beautiful question. It just, waiting creates, like, as you say it, like, I feel like my chest expanding. Like it's waiting creates capacity, you know, it just creates capacity inside of us. And we get that beautiful experience of like watching ourselves be brave, like watching ourselves stay engaged despite not knowing the outcome. It's incredibly growth promoting for the person who's doing it. I think sometimes a place where people get tripped up is they think that they get confused that somehow waiting is foolishness or weakness. You know, like if I don't know right now, like that somehow I'm weak if I don't know, or I'm weak if I'm waiting around while somebody else doesn't know. But instead, I think it's really courageous to stay in a situation where you don't know, you don't quite know how it's going to end. It's really, I think it's courageous. I think it's growth promoting. And I want people who are in that spot to feel just like proud of themselves, like to resist the urge to diminish it, like to say that it's foolish or silly. I was gonna say, it comes up a lot, probably among your peers, my daughter's peers, like, you know, seniors, high school seniors and college seniors, like as you are anticipating that huge transition, either out of high school and into college or out of college into life after college, there's so much uncertainty around like romantic relationships, especially, you know, like, are we going to stay together? Are we going to break up? Are we going to try long distance? Are we going to open up our relationship? Like, I think I have so much, when I teach, I'm often teaching college seniors. And so my office hours are very often students with that question of like, I'm falling in love with this person, but we're about to graduate, you know, I'm going here, they're going there. And I really like help them come back to how much courage it takes to just keep showing up for the relationship day after day when you don't know what's going to happen. You know, because sometimes what they'll say is like, I think I should break up with this person now because it will hurt less than, you know, at graduation or when we move, like trying to save themselves the hurt. And I think that makes so much sense to do, to try to figure out how am I going to choose a path that hurts less. But I want people to also just remember that there's a lot of courage and growth in just continuing to persist, even when you don't know what's going to happen next.
So how can we grow by waiting? And that doesn't necessarily mean even right now as high school seniors, but in our lives when we're just it's a moment of stagnation.
Yeah. And I do think that there are situations where waiting sometimes is a way of avoiding saying the hard thing or doing the hard, you know, so it's not, I think that there's, but I think that's like the way you're saying it, I think helps us feel into if the waiting feels like alive and dynamic versus if the waiting feels stagnated and flat. And I think that's something that like, it's where really like tuning into yourself probably is the wisest course, right? Is there something kind of alive, moving, shifting within this waiting? Or does the waiting really feel like it's Groundhog Day and every single day looks like the last one and nothing is shifting?
Oh, yeah.
I think that's probably the distinction, you know?
Of course. So what's the biggest thing you learned about people and relationships throughout your career?
Well, I guess the first thing that comes to mind is that we are just like messy in all of the best ways, you know, like I just could bring tears to my eyes, like just how wonderfully complicated we are, you know, and that we don't have to have ourselves all figured out. We don't have each other all figured out, but we can, there's something that like, I think probably early, especially early in my career as a therapist, I think I felt really probably threatened and scared about the because the therapy process is also uncertain, you know, and to be a therapist is to take a particular position in a relationship, right? A therapist has a position of power, authority, leadership, expertise in the relationship with the client. I think especially early in my career, I didn't have expertise or authority, you know, like that's something that kind of is practiced with time. But what I always had was curiosity and willingness to just be near somebody, like to sit near somebody with difficult questions or difficult challenges. And I think that's what kind of carries me through today still, is just being pretty endlessly fascinated by just how complicated it is to be a human. Complicated and messy, you know. I think that probably would be the biggest thing.
I love that. And I was reading, it stuck with me. I don't remember the full quote, but I was reading something and it was just, it just said, there are no absolutes in life. And it said, I think saying that there are absolutes is like saying that there's no night and day, something like that it was. And I was like, that's very interesting, because I feel like we often think one thing can apply to another, and this is this, and because X happened, Y will happen. You know, we think very logically sometimes, but in reality, if X doesn't happen, Y can still happen. And if X happens, Y can still happen. Maybe not happen, vice versa. Right. There's really not much correlation, because things can also just change at any moment.
That is, it makes me think about, like, that was one of the things I remember learning about Einstein's career, right? Is Einstein is credited with, like, just this, like, incredibly gifted mind, right? That just advanced, you know, advanced his field so beautifully. But that sort of towards the end of his career, that was a place he got to, is like, actually, there's some shit that you just can't figure out, right? The whole, like, I actually, there is still, even in mathematics, there are places, mathematics and physics, like there are places for mystery and surprise. And so I love that idea, right? About, and I think some of, you know, I think all of us in this world line up, you know, and how much our brains really demand order versus how much our brains are naturally suited to kind of sit with complexity. I think there's, you know, I think people who become scientists and engineers and accountants, they have brains that really do love, and thank God, right? Thank God for those brains, like, you know, for who are just, who can see through something, you know, kind of see to the heart of the matter, you know, quiet down the rest of the noise and just get really clearly from A to B. That's wonderful. It's a great attribute. But people who are like that do need to, their growing edge is to kind of soften, tolerate uncertainty. And then for those of us who are so comfortable sitting in a bunch of complexity, there are times where we do need to just kind of tighten it up and just make a decision, you know,
get it together. Yeah.
go somewhere.
Do something.
Do one thing.
One thing. Yeah. Everyone has their strengths and their weaknesses. And that goes back to what we were saying before, is that sometimes your strengths are your weaknesses and vice versa. Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. What's the greatest or the biggest thing that if you could go back and tell yourself, you'd say to her? If there's one thing that you could tell her, what's something that you would say?
I think probably, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is just, I probably would tell her to just be like gentle with herself, like that she will be, you know, ambitious and focused, whether she's talking sweetly to herself or harshly to herself. You know, I think that I spent and still catch myself, you know, at times believing that harshness is the only way to motivate myself, you know?
Yeah.
Yep. But I think I'm way, way, way more gentle with myself than I used to be. So to be, to trust that I can be gentle and motivated.
Yeah, I love that. And I think, again, like these days, especially, we struggle with that. It's like, how do I be rigid with myself? And how do I have that sense of diligence? Whereas, you know, you also need to have the sense of self-compassion, like we were saying.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Knowing that it is rest that allows us to come, you know, to come back to our work, right? It's by stepping away that in stepping away, we can step back in. Mm-hmm.
What are ways, this was another big question everybody had, is what are ways that we can also communicate more effectively with people and ourselves?
Mm-hmm. It's another, you know, it's another big one about like, that's why I love doing relationship education, is there's like actual things that you can learn that are helpful, but that we don't otherwise learn. Like, I don't know if you've had in high school, like any sort of, you know, relation, like there's probably not a whole lot of like relationship education. No. So I think this is, and I think communication is one where there's a lot, we know a lot about kind of how to help our communication be more effective. And it really is, I think it starts by being clear about why we're speaking, you know, like taking that pause, taking that breath, of like, why am I talking right now? Like, what is it that I, you know, like starting from that internal place and starting with, and you know, this, idea of like standing up for ourselves without putting somebody else down. Like it's not, relationships are not win-lose. And so much of our, especially today in this like very hyper-polarized political climate, I think that's part of like the sort of, there's a lot of like win-lose, good, bad, right, wrong. You're either, you know, kill or be killed, like that very zero sum mentality that's reflected in our politics, but it's also like reflected, I think, in interpersonal relationships. And so I think that effective communication is all about like holding the relationship in mind, right? That it's not about me versus you. It's about how do I speak for the kind of relationship that I want to have.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty principal.
Yeah. There's a sense of 0 and 100, but there's no sense of 50.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Right. And I think that there's like, I think if we want to put like a gender lens on it, I think part of the way that we socialize boys and men is that idea of you've got to keep a leg up and never let them see you sweat. Da, da, da. I think that's probably, that's part of, I think when I'm doing therapeutic work with men, especially like men in heterosexual relationships, a lot of it is helping him shift away from that mentality to something more relational. But I think for women, oftentimes for women, it's that they've watched the elder women in their family really become invisible and lose their voice and just take care of everybody else and kind of walk around chronically pissed off and silent. And so I think a lot of like younger women are like, okay, I know I don't want that. So that means that I have to be self-advocating 24/7 and I have to be never accommodating, never backing down. So I think there's a way in which, you know, younger women especially try to solve for the problems of patriarchy by staying so much in their voice. And I think that that can be similarly problematic, right? Is feeling like you have to always be watching your own back and always speaking up for yourself. You know, I think there's something that's like tricky for women also to figure out how to self-advocate while being really curious about the other person's perspective.
Yeah. And I think now that you say that, I really do realize how much that can impact our relationships as a whole, right? Mm-hmm. How much do we want to, how often do we want to go and try and fix a problem as opposed to just putting your hands back and being like, it is what it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right? Yep. And I think it's, the gender stuff is tricky, like especially in a post-Dobbs world where there are actual attacks on women's sovereignty.
Yes.
That there is a way, like there is feeling like you have to watch your back is not, you know, if you are a woman, if you are BIPOC, if you are queer, like that sense of like, I have to advocate for myself is a real, like actual lived kind of thing.
Of course.
So that need for ferocity, tenacity, self-protection, like that shit is real. Yeah. That is real.
Yes.
And I want people, especially people with one or more marginalized identities, to be cultivating relationships where they get to just exhale, where they don't actually have to be always watching to make sure that where they can put their hands back and say, it is what it is, because there's a level of safety, right? I can actually let this go because I do know that this person is in my corner. I do know this person respects my sovereignty. I do know this person, you know, respects my humanity. So that's in the mix too.
With that being said, what impact does having time separately and space from each other have on trust? And when may you know that you need space?
Mm-hmm. I think it's one of the highly romanticized myths that we come into relationships with is my friend, Dr. Wednesday Martin, a couple of years ago called it eroticized enmeshment. Like I think we do like kind of think that if it really is love, then you want to be together 24/7. Like to love somebody is to have no upper limit on time together. And I think that is a myth. I think to love somebody is to celebrate togetherness and to be able to trust separateness, right? To be able to step away from each other, to kind of like follow your own passions. I think, you know, healthy couples have lots of separate passions as well as shared passions. Healthy couples have separate friends as well as together friends. Like that, you know, that like sort of honoring separateness and togetherness is made possible by trust. So your connection, you connecting it to trust, you know, makes a lot of sense, right? That's relationships need both elements together and separate. And the way that you right. make that tolerable is by building a foundation of trust, that you're really clear that each of you honors the relationship, and you've defined together what honoring the relationship means. It means I don't talk shit about you behind your back. It means that I don't, you know, hook up with people when, you know, besides you, like whatever that is. Or, you know, if there is a flexible sexual boundary, I do hook up with people, but only under these conditions. Whatever the agreement is the couple has made, it's an agreement that both people understand and have agreed to honor. So therefore, when they're apart, you know, there's trust there that you'll have my back in the ways we've decided support this relationship. And so will I.
I have one more question for you. I'm keeping an eye on the time, but on a daily basis, right? How can we communicate effectively to build that trust, right? Because is it about really the deep conversations or the sit down, proper enclosed conversations that we have, or is it, this is how I'm going to communicate with you because I want to progressively establish that sense of trust.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I think that there is a world where couples are at risk of spending so much time in relationship talk that they are like spend more time talking about the relationship than they do actually doing the relationship. So I think that is like, if we're like, you know, certainly it's a risk to have zero self-awareness in a relationship or zero, but I think there also is a risk of like analyzing the shit out of the relationship and spending so much time picking it apart that you aren't just, you know, kind of having like whatever ease or play or just enjoying that time. So I do think that, I think some of it is conversation, but some of it also is behavior. You know, a lot of, I remember doing therapy years ago with a woman. She was a college student and her boyfriend had cheated on her and he felt like absolute crap about it. And he really wanted to repair. And the repair, the trust building was actually compromised by the fact that they were separated because they were both college students and they were at different schools, right? Because so much of how you build trust is just feeling, like how you feel in each other's presence.
Yeah.
Like, not about words. Like words can't replace that like felt sense of like, oh, you're my person. I'm safe with you. I feel that. Like we're animals. Like we're super clever, but we're animals. And so a lot of how we feel safe is our bodies feel safe. And so some of it is communication, but a lot of it is just like experiences of each other. How you smell, how my body feels near your body. Like it's like a sense that's beyond words.
How do you feel? I know we kind of undermine that it's your gut feeling, right? Feeling and how you feel as opposed to what you think you should feel.
Yep.
And what you're thinking, right? Like, yes, yep. X may go this way, but how do you feel about it? Mm-hmm. What do you think, right? Mm-hmm. Honoring that too.
Yep. It's a cool, in my field, it's a pretty cool chapter that we're just, you know, I think the field of psychology has been super heady and we're in this really cool new era of like re-honoring the body. It's pretty cool.
So one last quick question for you, and then I'm going to let you take the mic away, shout out everything and anything that you'd like to shout out. But before that, what is the best advice you've ever received?
I'm terrible at these on the spot questions. Okay. I know what it is. It is when I was, it's very specific. Probably not really relevant to much of your audience, but they can file it away for later. So when I was pregnant with our first son, I was, my supervisor at work said to me, when the baby comes, make sure that you have lots of time where your husband is totally 100% in charge of the baby and you step away, because the force of patriarchy and gender socialization, especially for straight couples, is that when a baby is born, it's the mom and it's the women of the family who kind of circle around that baby, and the husband gets kind of iced out. And the more he's not right in there from the ground floor, the more he can like do things like, well, I don't know how to do that. You know, like when none of it is like rocket science. So actually he can know how to do all of that. And so having My husband took a 4-week paternity leave and was like deeply in the weeds with me when we were first figuring out like what the hell to do with this little creature. And that I think set the foundation for their relationship. But I don't know that I would have gotten there if my supervisor hadn't been like, here's my advice to you. Make sure that he's super, super, super empowered and involved like from day one.
I love that. That's awesome. And that is very empowering to hear as well. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Dr. Solomon, I'm going to let you take the mic away. Please shout out anything and everything that you'd like to shout out. But I just want to tell the listeners that all of your links will be in the show notes so they can take a look. But take it away. It's yours.
Well, I think the best way to learn more about my work is my website, dralexandrasolomon.com. Yeah. And when you get there, you will see links to social media. I'm active on Instagram, and everything I post on Instagram goes onto Facebook. You can find the podcast there, which we talked about before, is called Reimagining Love. Got 2 books, a third one on the way in the fall. Yay. And e-courses. So the Marriage 101 course, I basically turned into an e-course. And so there's that e-course is available, and I've got a discount for college students, discount for BIPOC folk. And so if the course is interesting to you, but not financially feasible for you, for sure, you know, reach out and let me know, because we want this content to be available to anybody who's interested. We also have a course. I have a course on helping couples figure out whether trust can be rebuilt after a betrayal. And those are all the parts of my world.
Thank you so much. I hope you guys enjoyed today's episode of What's On Your Mind. Just in case you missed it, please don't forget to check out Leanna Jabs. She is currently hosting a self-worth retreat in Bali from July 30th to August 6th at the Gaia Retreat Center. I will make sure to leave some links in the description so that you can check it out. But you will basically come out of this retreat having learned to unconditionally love and accept yourself while building the skills you need to live your best life and stop self-sabotaging behaviors confidently. Listeners of the What's On Your Mind podcast get $300 off the total cost of the retreat. All you have to do is visit lovewithleanna.com/retreats and say that you're from What's On Your Mind, or just say that you're from the podcast and she'll know exactly what you're talking about. But this is really the place to reset yourself, reset your life. I know a lot of people have been looking for that lately. I find that more and more people are going on retreats and doing these kinds of things. So yeah, definitely don't forget to check it out. I think it's an experience of a lifetime, and you guys are getting one hell of a deal. So yeah, don't forget to check it out. Like I said, links will be in the description. And along with that, don't forget to check out Dr. Alexandra Solomon. She also, like I said, has a podcast. She's an author. She's doing phenomenal things. Even if you just want to keep up with her Instagram, you definitely should. That's like the real relationship advice that you need, not the stuff that you see on TikTok. Anyway, don't forget to check out her accounts, her book, her podcast, and then I will also leave the link to the retreat in the description in case anyone is interested or even wants to learn more about Leanna's coaching, because she does coaching. She's also a Reiki certified coach, which is amazing. And then also Dr. Solomon, who is a relational self-awareness expert. But yeah, aside from that, I think we actually covered just about everything. But I hope you guys enjoyed today's episode, and I will see you next week for